Voices in the Family. By the time I finish reading this introduction, some of you will have stopped paying attention. It's not that you're disinterested. Well, I hope it's not that you're disinterested. It's simply that ADHD is increasing at a rate of 3% a year. It's more prevalent now than ever. But is it simply overdiagnosed and overmedicated? Or is it really increasing? Are there alternative methods to dealing with this crippling disorder than just medication? For many children, ADHD can turn the classroom, even the schoolyard, into a nightmare. Those suffering do poorly in school. They have lower self-esteem, and they're more prone to depression. Actually, I was one of them. Parents are often faced with difficult decisions about what to do, especially when it comes to medication. Joining me today to discuss these issues and more is Dr. Tom Power. He's director of the Center for Management of ADHD at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dan.
Tom reminded me he was on the show about 20 years ago discussing the same thing. Also joining me on the telephone is Dr. Steven Silverman, a school psychologist and author of School Success with ADHD. Steven, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you on the show today. Our listeners, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I strongly suggest you call early in the show. There's going to be a lot of you that want to talk to our experts. Tom, let's start with you. I want to understand first what ADHD is, and then we'll talk about what it isn't.
Okay. ADHD is a condition that is characterized by short attention span, variable attention, and usually problems with behavior regulation. Most children and adolescents with ADHD have actually both the inattentive and the hyperactive forms of this disorder, although some children and adolescents have only the inattentive version, and some only have the hyperactive version.
You have said it usually appears before age 7. So what does it look like before academics?
Yeah, it typically arises before the age of 7. And, when children are preschoolers or kindergartners, they're typically very hyperactive and impulsive. They often have a difficult time staying in their seat in their preschool and kindergarten class. And unfortunately, many of these children frequently are asked to leave the preschool setting and to go to other preschools. So early on, it's typically characterized by hyperactivity. Most of the children who are hyperactive when they're young actually grow into having the form of ADHD that involves inattention as well.
Hmm. Steven, Tom talked about short attention span, but the world has a short attention span. I mean, if you watch a movie today versus 20 years ago or a TV show, I mean, these cutaways are in milliseconds. I mean, everything's happening much more quickly. So to what extent is it a child's pathology, and to what extent is it the world's pathology?
Well, I think it's both. Certainly it is a very real personal neurobehavioral pathology, if you want to use that term. But the world has changed. Just the other night I was showing some friends a movie that I thought was fabulous, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and we all got bored. I said, my goodness, I didn't remember it moved that slow. So I do understand how information is moving at a very fast rate, and the younger folks are able to manipulate and respond to information in a very fast manner. But I still think there's a substantial number of us in the population who suffer from this disabling condition.
I want to come back to you, Tom. My opening question was I wanted to talk to you about what it is and what it isn't. So many kids are over-medicated with ADD, ADHD drugs that don't really have it. And the problem is these drugs are really used as a chemical restraint. I mean, they work. They mm-hmm. calm kids down. I just read an article about the percentage of foster kids who were on ADHD medication is sky high. Now, that's, you got to wonder if they're medicating behavior that just doesn't fit. So are these drugs being used to mask a variety of other things?
I think it's a really good point. I think that the question of the overuse of medication really, the overuse really varies depending upon the population that we're talking about. I think in some suburban, highly affluent communities in which parents and perhaps adults with ADHD are well informed about the disorder, I think there could potentially be a tendency to kind of pull the trigger quickly and make the assumption that you have ADHD when there could be other kinds of things going on, or perhaps milder forms of inattention that don't require medication. I'm sensitive, however, to some many disadvantaged communities in which the knowledge of ADHD is not all that great, and even the knowledge among providers in those communities may not be all that great, and there tends to be an underdiagnosis. I'm thinking we do a lot of work in West and Southwest and South Philadelphia, and we're aware of relatively low rates of diagnosis and relatively low rates of medication usage. So it's a complex question. It really depends upon, I think, a lot of demographic issues and socioeconomic factors.
Let's go to the phones. We've got somebody who wants to follow up on our medication question. Matthew?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My brother was diagnosed with ADHD and was on medication for years when we were children. We're both in our mid-20s now, and I was wondering if there's any long-term results on, you know, people who've aged out of the medication and what their lives are like now. Because my brother's struggling with addiction and all kinds of things.
May I ask what he's addicted to?
Currently, he uses a lot of alcohol, but it's been marijuana, it's been religion, it's been all
okay.
kinds of things.
Okay, I get it. Anyone want to comment on that? Stephen, Tom?
Yeah, I might say a few words on that. I certainly feel for your brother and what he's going through. There isn't a lot of evidence that the medications, particularly the stimulants, over the long run are particularly addictive. Now, there are, unfortunately, we've been reading about the use of stimulants in some of the Ivy League schools as a designer drug, and there are having cases of kids who are young people who have habitual use of the substance. Actually, ADHD never really, in most cases, goes away. And over the lifespan might change a little bit. A person might become maybe less motorically restless, but may still be impulsive. I would be very concerned about a good psychological profile of your brother as a whole person, and taking into consideration the ADHD and all the other issues, and try to find a balance in treatment that might or may not include medication. But there's no particularly good reason to discontinue medications if they're properly prescribed and effective over the long run.
Well, and Matthew, I might want to bring up an additional issue, and I'm going to turn to both my guests and talk about proper evaluation. What you're describing with your brother, and I don't want to diagnose based on secondhand information of a few seconds, but if he's addicted to all these different things, you're talking about compulsivity. You're talking about compulsive behavior, and that might be unrelated to the ADHD. It might have been there his whole life. Medication might have masked it. It might be breaking through now. These are questions that come up that really must be answered and might not have been asked in the first place. So I'm going to just raise that with you, Matthew, and thank you for your call and what it brings up. And I want to ask both of you guys. I write a column, Stephen, for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and in today's article, I wrote about a woman who brought her, I think it was 12-year-old son, to a neuropsychiatrist at the recommendation of his school. And after 45 minutes, he was diagnosed with ADHD and walked out with a prescription. So how do we diagnose ADHD? I think I'll turn to you, Stephen.
Well, thank you. The assessment of ADHD in some ways is very simple, but most often very complicated. Sometimes the symptoms are so clear with the absence of any coexisting conditions that a well-trained pediatrician or general physician who follows the pediatric guidelines of the American Association of Pediatrics or in some form modified or can use good judgment and maintain a relationship with the client and the family to monitor medication in a shorter period of time. But quite generally, the question of assessment is very complicated, although there are a number of instruments put together, and observations, behavioral consultations, a wide armamentarium, a wide selection of tools, when integrated, can help make a very accurate diagnosis, actually.
Tom?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with that. And, you know, we rely very heavily upon parent interview and a child interview. And that covers a lot of different areas of problems, not just attention and learning problems. And, I mean, the caller raises for me some questions about possible coexisting conditions that may be there in addition to ADHD. ADHD in and of itself doesn't dispose to drug and alcohol addiction. The use of stimulant medication in and of itself typically does not dispose to the use or to drug and alcohol addiction. But some of the comorbid conditions, oppositional defiant disorder, conduct problems, internalizing difficulties can increase the risk of drug and alcohol addiction. So a thorough evaluation will assess for ADHD, emotional difficulties, and behavioral problems.
But define that. I mean, how does a parent know when they're getting a thorough evaluation? What does it look like?
Well, you certainly want to go to a competent individual, somebody who has a good reputation with regard to understanding ADHD, working with families and working with schools. We use a relatively structured interview. I mean, every clinician is going to interview families. I mean, that's just typical, but...
Let me interrupt.
Yes?
Every clinician should interview.
Every clinician should interview, right.
And I also want to add one other caveat. Not every clinician is trained in ADD diagnosis,
that's
or ADHD.
Right. That's right.
It's important to find that out before you go to the clinician.
Yeah. So you want a clinician who is an expert working with children. Some clinicians might portray themselves as working with everybody, but they may not have that much experience working with children and teens. I always look for somebody who works with the entire family, not just with the child. And I look for people who work with the school. And many clinicians will not work with the school. They may not call the teacher. They may not be willing to visit the school if need be.
Do you think that's an important part of
diagnosis? I think it's an important part. I mean, we always guide our parents to look for clinicians who are willing to work with the school if need be. And, you know, when you're dealing with ADHD in children, you're almost always dealing with school issues. So you need a clinician who understands the school and who is willing to collaborate with the teacher at the very least by phone.
We're going to take a short break. We've got a lot of callers we want to get to. When we come back, I want to introduce you guys and our listeners to a family who's struggled with ADHD, and we'll talk about that for a bit. We're talking about ADHD, and we're doing that with Dr. Stephen Silverman, who joins me by telephone. He's the author of Success with ADHD. He is a psychologist in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area, and he's director of assessment services with the Jewish Social Services there. I'm here in the studio with Tom Power. He's a psychologist, professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's director of the Center for the Management of ADHD at Children's Hospital. Our number is 888-477-9499, and I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY and presents Napoleon, a new exhibit that explores the private life of Napoleon Bonaparte and his impact on the United States and the world. With over 300 rare pieces, including personal belongings, furniture, and fine art, Napoleon, on view at the National Constitution Center now through September 7th. Details at constitutioncenter.org. Presented by Shire Pharmaceuticals, Exhibits Development Group, and Cultural Arts Entertainment Group, distributors and producers.
On the next Fresh Air, a prescription for healthcare reform. We talk with Maggie Mahar, who writes the HealthBeat blog and is author of Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much. Also, Armando Iannucci, director of the new political satire In the Loop. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 3 and again at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about ADD and ADHD with Dr. Tom Power. He's director of the Center for Management of ADHD at Children's Hospital. I'm also talking with Dr. Stephen Silverman. He's director of assessment services at the Jewish Social Service Agency in Washington, D.C., and he's written School Success with ADHD. I'm going to play a clip before we get to your calls, and I do want to get to how we treat it, what we're learning about, what works and what doesn't. But I want to play a clip of a family that our associate producer, Lisa Walter, spoke with. Their oldest child, Matthew, was diagnosed with ADHD at age 5. He's now 12. We'll hear from his mother, we'll hear from Matthew, and we'll hear from his 10-year-old sister, Erin. So let's take a listen.
I always said, oh, ADHD, it's just a made-up. And this was before I had kids. It's a made-up diagnosis, and that's not going to be me. And I think that that's probably why it took me as long as it did to come to grips with the fact that, yes, he really does have ADHD. It started when he was very little, probably about 2.5, 3 years old. I started doing Mommy and Me playgroups and noticed that he just played very, very differently than the other children. He rarely ever slept. I mean, at 3 years old, it would be nap time, and I would go in after an hour, and he had taken his toddler bed apart and put his mattress against his dresser. And when I walked in, he'd say, "Look, Mom, I made a slide," and would climb up his dresser and slide down his mattress.
I used to always, like, just run around the house and trying to beat my sister. I was always like knocking over things on purpose and breaking them. And I would just always put things in my mouth.
We did a lot of occupational therapy treatment, and that seemed to work. And then finally, the summer before kindergarten, things just started escalating more with his behaviors, and I had decided at that point I had finally come to terms with the diagnosis of ADHD and decided that if we were going to go into kindergarten, I was going to make the most out of his education, and decided the summer before kindergarten to start him on medication for ADHD.
I feel like a different person, and I've just been doing great, and I'm just glad to have a family as supportive as mine.
We're always on the run. We're always going. He goes weekly to a psychologist. His sister goes every other week to the psychologist because this has had a large impact on her life as well.
My mom and my dad, really, I feel like they pay a lot of attention to him and not really to me.
We go monthly to the psychiatrist for medication checks. So I feel like we're always running.
It's a lot better with him on his medicine, and life is a lot easier.
I've learned to look at ADHD as a gift. It's a crazy, zany gift that I have this wonderful child who is bright and articulate and verbal, and at times can be wacky and off the wall, and it's part of who he is, but it isn't what he is, and that he will determine what he is and what he becomes.
I see myself either being a chef or being a star, I gotta make the most of my life. That's my motto, make the most of your life. And what I mean by that is don't waste your life on just one thing.
So I gotta come out of this and ask a question I wasn't going to ask, and I'll direct it to you, Tom. You know, people want to know about relationship between ADHD and all sorts of other illnesses. Is there a relationship between ADHD and IQ? This is a bright kid.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, generally speaking, there's not much of a relationship, okay, believe it or not. I mean, individuals with ADHD can have the full range of IQ, and this child obviously is very bright and very creative, and there's the full range, Dan.
All right, I was just curious. So, Stephen, when we listen to Matthew, we hear it, a kid who was pretty aggressive, I don't want to say violent, but pretty aggressive, risk-taking. When we see a young child who's aggressive or risk-taking, should we begin to think ADHD, that that's what's going on?
Not necessarily, but I think it's important. Dr. Power very eloquently noted how it's important to consider coexisting conditions. And very frequently, I would say, depending on who's measuring it, somewhere between 40% and 70% of youngsters have this we call oppositionality or oppositional behavioral themes, and these are part of what we need to look at when we're addressing the whole child. And in some cases, the medication, especially in a very attentive and organized family like this, can actually also lessen some of these more aggressive behaviors, as well as the impulsivity and the motor restlessness and the recklessness that we saw there.
Tom, he said in the clip, he said, "I feel like a totally different kid." Is that good news or bad news?
I heard that as wonderful news, because it basically made reference to his self-esteem. Interesting, probably even at a young age, at 5-6 years of age, he had a sense of himself perhaps being somebody who doesn't do the right thing a lot of the times, gets parents upset, gets teachers upset, annoys his brother. And apparently on the medication, and I also, it sounds like they were using other interventions as well. With that combination of interventions, the child was able to be much better under control and feel a lot better about himself and feel a lot more optimistic and view himself as a competent person.
Stephen, we touched on this clip on impact on siblings. Is there any research that you know of about the impact of ADHD on SIBs?
Well, yes, there actually is a body of research, as well as guides for children and books for children and therapeutic approaches for children who are in a family where a sibling has ADHD.
So what kind of impact does it have? I mean, this you know, daughter felt she was being overlooked. I assume that's quite common.
I think that's probably the most common thing that I hear, and I certainly would defer to Dr. Power for other aspects of siblings' development. But certainly feeling overshadowed, feeling that all the family time is being spent on one of the youngsters, can make a youngster feel very left out. And that is one of the most common things that I run across.
Stephen, his final comment sounded like an adaption to ADHD. You know, when he said, don't waste your life on one thing, I want to do a lot of things. I mean, this sounds like a kid with ADD, and his vision of himself is an adult with a mind that is doing a lot of things at the same time.
Yes. However, I think that all of us who work in this field have to start with a strengths model and forgiving the negative behaviors and keeping in mind the youngster as someone with a future. And I'm reminded of Michael Phelps, who was able to use this, who has ADHD, and was able to use his drive for future orientation of trying not to waste time. Now, frequently what we can do if we know what our strengths are and if we can sometimes get a purpose in life or at least a self-assessment where we're doing the things that we love and do best, that we can circumvent a lot of the problems, not avoid them. But this youngster, he was interesting, Dan, in that he did look forward to a concentrated and purposeful but split future.
Right, right, exactly. let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the discussion. We'll start with Katie.
Hi, my daughter is 8 years old, she was diagnosed with hyperactivity at 8 years old. She's now 9, almost 10. And she was diagnosed by educational psychologists at our local children's hospital. And while we were waiting to get in to see the child psychiatrist there, we started her on Focalin and then tried Concerta. And after trying a couple of dosages without any noticeable effect, we decided to stop the medication. In the meantime, we got an appointment with the psychiatrist who realized she needed to be treated for depression, which for which she has a very strong family history. And after she was on Prozac for about 6 months, the psychiatrist worked very closely with the school, and we decided to try Focalin. And she had already tried that once, but with the Prozac on board, the Focalin had dramatic effects. And I'm wondering what the link is between depression and ADHD and whether you can really tell what's what.
Let me pass your question on to my experts, but I will save them the energy of the caveat. Neither one of them are physicians and can address the medication issue specifically.
Okay.
But that said, they're both experts and can address the issue of depression and comorbid condition.
Mm-hmm.
Tom.
Yeah. So actually what you seem to be describing is a child with ADHD and a coexisting depressive disorder. It sounds as if you said that there was a family history of depression.
Yeah.
And so she may very well come by the depression genetically. Mm-hmm. There's always it can be really tricky when you have coexisting conditions to figure out, you know, which condition to make a priority for the treatment. And I guess the general rule of thumb is to start with the behaviors or the impairments that are most concerning, kind of target them for treatment and then go on from there.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps at the outset, the primary concerns related to the depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so they instituted the Prozac, which is a medication treatment for depression. Prozac and medications like that do not do a good job treating symptoms of ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not surprising that there were questions about using a stimulant medication like a Focalin or a Concerta after the child had been treated relatively successfully for depression using medication.
But it actually was very successful.
The Prozac.
When they added the Focalin.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Her focus changed, but also her mood was tremendous.
Yeah.
And she may have been in a better mood because of being more successful in school and being able to attend more, but I and her teachers were just shocked at the level of change when we added the Focalin.
Well, that's the other thing we have to address. And Katie, I want to thank you for your call. That, you know, we're trying to ferret out chicken and egg, which we never will with these coexisting conditions. But we also have to talk about how ADHD, depression, can be a byproduct. You know, if you're living your life feeling different from the other kids, struggling to stay afloat. I mean, I did that, and I had a, if not depression, dysthymia, a low-grade depression. So it can be the fallout of the ADHD, and perhaps you treat the ADHD successfully and the depression could dissipate. But I guess all this gets ferreted out, hopefully, in the evaluations.
Yes, that's right. And so it's, I mean, when you have ADHD, I mean, you're typically getting a lot of negative feedback from teachers in school, from peers, and from parents. And the accumulation of negative feedback over a period of time can really drive the self-esteem down and perhaps set in motion or trigger a process of depression. If you're already prone to being depressed, perhaps genetically, then it could really make the depression
right.
more severe.
Right. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Molly on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Molly.
I was diagnosed with ADD when I was in fifth grade, and I just remember hearing that most kids are diagnosed quite a lot younger than that, and I was wondering if there was any difference in how kids sort of accept the condition based on age, or how easy it is to diagnose and how easy it is to figure out a treatment option.
Before I turn your question over to our experts, how old are you, Molly, may I ask?
I'm 22 now.
And so what's your answer? How is it for you in accepting the condition?
It was actually quite difficult for me to accept it in fifth grade, having struggled with the symptoms of it for a while up until then. I think it would have helped had I known more about it before the option of medication had come up, because all of a sudden it seemed like an illness or a disease instead of something that was just a little bit different about me that could maybe be fixed.
Molly, how about now?
Sorry?
How about now? How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Since I'm out of college now, I'm still on medication, but it's definitely gotten a lot easier to manage the ADD as I've gotten older.
And tell me, if I may get personal here, tell me about how's your relationship with you? How are you feeling about yourself?
I think I've grown to accept it a lot more as just an aspect of me as a person, and maybe to use it sort of to, I don't know about to my advantage, but to think about how it impacts my life more instead of trying to stuff it away in a closet somewhere.
Yeah, good for you. Good for you. I really appreciate your call. I'm going to direct your question to Stephen. And are you aware of the impact on kids of getting this label, depending on the age, their age?
Well, yes. You know, what's most interesting in Molly's case, and there's a couple of things I'd like to ask her about her core symptoms that she has experienced, is that girls are quite different. I think most of us find in our practices that we have young ladies come to us much later because most frequently the expression of disorder is in the predominantly inattentive type. They tend to be less attentive, and they may not be as reckless or wild or impulsive as the boys. There are, of course, exceptions, but we get them often quite late, even in high school, where they have difficulty sustaining attention to register information, to comprehend information, and they become very frustrated. Many times they've been working much harder than other children just to read things over and over again, for example. So girls have perhaps most often a different pattern of mostly inattention.
Interesting. We've got to take another break. When we come back, we're going to devote the rest of our show to treatments, to what works, what doesn't work, and for whom. We are talking about ADHD. My guests are Steven Silverman. He's on the phone. He's the author of School Success with ADHD. I'm also joined here in the studio by Dr. Tom Power. He's with the Department of Pediatrics at Penn. He's also director of the Center for Management of ADHD at Children's Hospital. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're going to be talking about treatment, so if you've got any questions or answers about treatment, give us a call. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Kimmel Center Presents supports WHYY and welcomes organist Annalise Smoot to Verizon Hall on Thursday, July 30th. A Philadelphia native and winner of the National Young Artists Competition of the American Guild of Organists, Ms. Smoot will perform Bach's Passacaglia in C minor, as well as works by Langlais and Widor. Organist Annalise Smoot, Thursday, July 30th at the Kimmel Center. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or kimmelcenter.org.
As Cooperstown prepares to welcome this year's class of baseball greats, we welcome author Larry Tye. His new book details the life of a baseball legend.
Satchel Paige was arguably the best pitcher ever to throw a baseball.
A new look at the pitcher who broke all conventions in the Negro Leagues and the majors. Next time on Tell Me More. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about ADHD with Steven Silverman. On the telephone, he's the author of School Success with ADHD, and Tom Power. He's here in the studio, director of the Center for the Management of ADHD at Children's Hospital. Let's go right to the phones. David, you're on the line.
Hello.
Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Dan. Sure. I'm a middle-aged adult, 45. My wife is 40. We both had ADHD when we were growing up in the 60s and 70s, of which they declared us being learning disabled. At the time, they didn't know what to do with us. And essentially, and to be blunt, put us in the classes for dummies. It wasn't until I got past the grade school level into high school where I then was allowed to go to vocational technical for electronics that I felt better and succeeded in my own self. And then I realized that, wait a minute, I'm not bad. I'm just really, really smart, and these kids don't like something's going wrong. We now have a toddler, a girl, and she is starting to exhibit the same signs that both my wife had as we grew up, such as anger, such as temper tantrums. She's also extremely intelligent. Our choice now is to either put her in the public school system and allow her to go through that, or to homeschool her and deal with the ADHD problem as parents directly. Hmm. Any comment from your guest would be appreciated. Secondly, as yourself, I'm also a combat veteran, so I understand and see things from a different perspective.
Yeah. David, thanks so much for your call. It's a great question, terribly important one. I'll start with you, Stephen.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you, caller, for getting in touch with us. I think that things have changed in special education in terms of identification and in treatment, and in many centers like the one that Dr. Power has, where we can be much more attentive to following your daughter up as she develops, and having a more reasonable, fair, and compassionate school. And certainly there are ways to shop for a compassionate school. I'm not particularly an advocate of homeschooling or non-homeschooling. It's more a question that your daughter is carefully identified in her emerging skills and weaknesses, and that they're addressed. So I think even at this young age, given the high risk for ADHD in the family, a proper assessment would be the very first place that I would start.
And you really hit the buzzword here, that assessing strengths and weaknesses is way more important than finding the label and, you know, working with strengths and weaknesses. Tom, what's your take on David's dilemma here? He's got a child who's at risk. I'm going to make the question unreasonable for you. Mm-hmm. What would you do if it was your two-year-old?
Yeah, well, to get to the issue of maybe public school versus homeschooling, I mean, there are two really different types of settings. I mean, one of the assets with regard to homeschooling is that the parents have a lot of control over variables. You know, with research on the internet, good consultation, they can really take control of educational programming, behavioral interventions, and so forth. The downside, however, is limited resources for dealing with all kinds of different things that could arise related to learning challenges, emotional difficulties, behavioral problems. Most parents just have a limited number of resources available to them. In public school, you have a really wide range of resources. You have a variety of teachers. You have special education, counselors, nurses, administrators, folks to step in and provide consultation.
So, and there's a great downside, too, that you know, a child could get labeled and lost. So what can – let's look at public schools for a minute. What can David do or any parent do to increase the chances that their child's going to get the best care they can in public schools?
So I would make an appointment with the principal several months before your child attends school. Sit down and describe the strengths and the limitations of your child. Talk with the principal about some of the challenges that may arise. Find out what resources the school has available, what options may be available. See if you can kind of tailor make a program that would fit the needs of the child. Teacher selection is usually a good variable to consider. Not all teachers are equally good in working with children who have ADHD. You want to have a teacher who understands ADHD, who likes these children, and who is invested in working with families.
So the bottom line is stay on top of it.
Stay on top of it, and don't assume that the plan that you come up with in the beginning is going to work for an entire year, and don't assume the plan that you have 1 year will work the next year.
Well, they get reviewed every 3 months anyway.
The individualized education plan would get reviewed periodically,
right.
And other school plans do. But oftentimes, school intervention programs for children with ADHD are not formalized, unfortunately, and so you may need to request a regular review for modification of intervention.
Yeah, David, thanks so much for your call. I do hope this was helpful. The other factor for homeschooling is, you know, he's got two parents with ADHD. I mean, I've got ADD, and I sure as hell wouldn't want my young kids educated by somebody like me.
I have one message for David also, if I may. This is Steve Silverman, and that is that many jurisdictions have a preschool screening program, childhood programs, and often they are teams with often a school or clinical psychologist with experience. So we can start very early in identifying and monitoring prior to developing a comprehensive in-school plan.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah, we have that here. I know you got a wonderful program in Maryland. I want to get to treatments. I want to get to what works and what doesn't work. And let's go back to the phones. We've got Gary on the line who's been waiting patiently.
Hello. I'm a psychologist specializing in brainwave biofeedback training, or neurofeedback, and I wanted to announce that the Journal of Clinical EEG and Neuroscience has just published a meta-analysis this month of over a dozen studies, 1,200 subjects. A meta-analysis is a statistical technique that combines many studies to make an overall judgment, and because there are several recent well-controlled research studies, we've put the level of evidence over the top, and the authors conclude that neurofeedback is both efficacious and specific for ADHD.
So I think that's great. I'm curious about, well, we'll start with you, Tom. What are your thoughts about neurofeedback? Gary, thanks so much for your call.
Well, I think neurofeedback is really a promising area for intervention. And the caller is really correct in pointing out that there are a number of studies that are providing supportive evidence for the effectiveness of neurofeedback. I think that, you know, I'm part of an expert panel that reviews interventions on a regular basis. And, you know, we are taking a close look at neurofeedback. And we're, you know, I think there needs to be more and more research with regard to not only its efficacy, but also is it feasible for many families? Some of the questions have to do with the length of treatment and the expense and whether it would be accessible for many families. But I actually think it's promising. I historically have not used neurofeedback, but I've been taking a close look at the research and think that there may be some promise there.
What about other methods that are external, that are non-medication, to calm the brain? Things like meditation, mm-hmm. yoga, traditional ones, even acupuncture. I read a tiny study last year about taking walks in nature for 15 minutes calmed the brain. So what are your thoughts about that, Stephen?
Well, thank you so much. That's one of the areas in my book where we cover complementary and alternative medication and hard research on it. I'm also aware of the emerging promise, perhaps, of neurofeedback, but I'm very, very interested in self-calming, such as meditation, simple forms of meditation and yoga, and there is a lot of talk of a nature deprivation disorder. Certainly, there are natural environments that we all respond to and are more calmer than others. For example, some of us are calmer at the beach or in the mountains. It doesn't cure ADHD. But I think there's a lot of promise and needs to be more research on, for example, meditation and other, say, perhaps less costly at the present time, interventions.
Well, and these other interventions might be less costly, but they're more work and they require more attention on the part of the practitioner. I've got a friend of mine who teaches meditation in elementary school class, and the thing they love best, he brings in his brass bells, and they love best when he starts. He rings the bells, and they listen carefully. For the first moment, the sound stops.
You know, I want to make one comment about this, though. I'm a great proponent of an integrated multimodal plan, as recommended by NIMH, for example, and I'm very interested in complementary medicine or alternative medicine. But it's important to note that we're not necessarily going to cure
right.
permanently with some of them. They certainly are very important and can be revolutionary, but not necessarily a total cure.
Right, that's a very good point. Well, let's talk about what works, what doesn't work, and moreover, what's realistic for an average family. Tom, you wanted to say.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that we point out that there are some clear-cut, proven methods, non-pharmacologic methods for addressing family and school difficulties and for that matter, peer relationship problems. And they use what we call behavioral strategies. And there's no real magic there. It's understanding children well, organizing the environment so that it prompts children to behave in a responsible and attentive way. And the age-old recommendation of using positive reinforcement for children when they are attentive and responsible is a really good idea. And I know that it probably, we talk about this all the time, actually instituting it on a regular basis is difficult for all of us, including myself. Using positive reinforcement frequently, strategically, reinforcing adaptive, responsible behavior much, much more than offering reprimands or correction is a good idea. And there are hundreds of studies to demonstrate that. I would also just want to point out that generally speaking, for the treatment of ADHD, the optimal approach is a combination of medication and behavioral treatments applied at home and school.
Which raises the question, though, Tom, about what's realistic for an average family.
Yeah, and I that obviously has to be taken into consideration. We talk about the optimal treatment for a family is what is evidence-based and what they want to do and find feasible to do. It's a balance of both. It can't just be the doctor saying, this is what the evidence is, this is what you need to be doing. It has to be guided by evidence, but it has to take into account the preferences, the goals, and what's feasible for the family and for the school.
You know, right before we started doing the show, Tom, and you know, I have mentioned throughout the show that I had ADD, and the fallout was pretty devastating for me. I did poorly in school. I started to get Fs. I flunked out of college the first time I went in. My self-esteem was quite low, and I battled that for a long time. On the other hand, here I am now, some 40 years later, and I'm a happy guy, and I'm pretty accomplished. And so I don't know what would have happened if I was diagnosed and labeled and medicated back then. I'm thinking it's unlikely I'd be where I am today.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you disclosing that, Dan. And I think perhaps there are a couple of implications. I'm not sure what would have happened to you either, and so maybe thank God things worked out as they did. But, you know, it's a testament, too, that having ADHD is not bad news long term for a lot of folks.
And that's the point that has to
and
be
a lot
made.
Of folks do real well. And you know, probably at least half of adults end up doing really, really well. And
that's very important. Yeah. And unfortunately, we got to close. We're out of time. My guests have been Stephen Silverman. He has written School Success with ADHD. I'm Tom Power here in the studios, psychologist director of the Center for Management of ADHD at TOP. Next week, we'll be talking about insomnia. Hey, tomorrow on my web chat, we're going to be talking more about learning disabilities and what we can do about them. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of radio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. She's out today, and we all wish you well. Our intern's Jonathan Glick. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You've been enjoying